Yes, sir, yes. It's time for episode 9 of Semi-Coherent Computing. This is your host, Ashley Vance, bringing you a very special show. We have Chris Hipp returning to the program as usual, and we also have computing legend Dave Patterson on the program. Dave is famous for his work with RISC chips and RAID storage, and also these days on systems that are work with heavily multi-cored boxes and multi-threaded software. And he's also exploring how to bring multi-core technology down to mobile devices. Dave is famous for his breakthrough technology and also for authoring some of the best-known papers and books in the computing industry, including a paper on RISC with Dave Ditzel, who was on the show a couple weeks ago, and kind of the standard processor textbook with John Hennessy from Stanford. Before we jump into them, I will do a bit of shameless self-promotion. My book is finally out this week. It's kind of a history of Silicon Valley. You can find more information at theduckrabbit.com. And with that, Dave, thanks for joining us today.
Happy to be here.
And Chris, thanks for popping on as well.
Appreciate it.
Dave, you know, there's a lot of information about you available on the web, and there's some oral histories, but you know, just for the people who might not be familiar, before we get into the technology stuff, could you just give us a little bit of your personal background? It looked to me like you were a California boy.
Yeah, that's what I would say. I think I like being at a place that calls itself Cal. immigrated. My parents moved here right after World War II because housing was cheap in California. And so I grew up here since I, you know, did all my education here. And after graduating from high school in Southern California in a beach community, so I grew up in a surfing culture and car culture, I guess, in Southern California. I went to UCLA, and while I was there, a faculty member took pity on me because I was supporting myself working in a factory, and got me a job in a research group. And so then I decided to go to a master's degree, and then everybody in the office was getting a PhD, so that seemed like a good idea to me. So then I'm kind of this accidental PhD academic.
I should ask as well. I mean, do you prefer Dave or David? Just so I'm not.
Most people call me Dave. Okay. I respond to either.
I just didn't want to offend you through the whole show.
I know people who feel strongly that they're David and not Dave, and I just don't understand that.
So. And when you were doing your PhD work, was that in computer science?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, computing. My undergraduate degree was going to be in math, and then at UCLA, and then a class was canceled. I couldn't get in, so I took this computer course. And as far as I can recall, I had no particular thoughts about computers until I took the course, and then I got exposed to programming, and this was just too much fun. So I was hooked, and I took every computer course I could in the business school, and there was no computer science undergraduate degree yet. So then I got hooked on it and just kept going as long as I could.
And you went straight into being a professor after you got your PhD?
Yeah, while I was a graduate student, I had to support myself. I worked at Hughes Aircraft, which was, you know, an aerospace company. And we actually did process computer design. So I took basically software classes, but I did hardware in supporting myself in graduate school. And we did airborne computers. And in fact, we did one of the first or possibly only wafer scale computers. Hughes Aircraft had its own fab line, believe it or not, and they could do wafer scale integration. So we built a wafer scale integrated computer. And I don't know if that's the only one in the world, but certainly one of the only ones in the world. So that was my hands-on hardware education.
And so you were kind of doing that work, and then but at the same time, you were still in academia.
I was still trying to get my PhD, so I was part time at Hughes while I was trying to finish my PhD. And depending, since I had a wife and two kids, some of that I was part time, 40 hours a week.
Right. And once you were a full professor and that's what you were focused on, what was the first kind of big project that you sank your teeth into?
After I graduated, the very first project was a multiprocessor project, and unfortunately we didn't have any skills or resources to do that, so we kind of floundered away at it a couple of years. And then I took a leave and went to Digital Equipment Corporation because I had done my dissertation on microprogramming, particularly programming language tools for microprogramming to make it easier to write microprograms. And while I was on that leave at DEC, it made me stop and reflect about, you know, the research that I've been doing at Berkeley. And then in particular, I was doing microcode tools for the VAX. So I got to see the inside development of the VAX architecture, which had a lot of microcode in it. And I think that time to reflect about how do you get work done in academia and the problems in getting the microcode right in the VAX led directly to on my return to work on the RISC project, which is, you know, second actual project, and it was the, you know, the one that saved my career, I'd say.
So you're saying it was the second RISC project, but
it was the first RISC project, but it was the second, you know, research project I tried to work on.
Oh, okay, I see. Because I saw there, when I was doing my research, it seemed like there was a little bit of RISC work that was being done, but that you weren't even aware of at the time.
Right. Certainly, John Koch, I mean, we coined the RISC term. He didn't call it that, but the guys at IBM were doing that work. I think they started in 75 or so doing their work in the area.
But then you guys at Berkeley, you developed the first RISC chip.
Yeah, so what the kind of the, it's a little hazy. Well, if I think about me personally, and Hennessy too, both of us were doing kind of language stuff related to microcode. You know, which, and if you squint your eyes at microcode, it's kind of simple instructions that you compile into. So the logical distance between what we were doing in our dissertations and what it ultimately became RISC computers wasn't that big. And in fact, while I was at Hughes, we did a kind of a paper design of what was more or less you could consider a microprogrammable computer, in that it was a, you know, it was inspired by microcode, but you'd write it in a higher level language and compile it. And we did a paper design of that while I was at Hughes. So that was, you know, early on. So the fact that when I came back from digital equipment, basically I wrote this paper for IEEE Computer that says the only way, basically what was happening at the time is the microprocessor guys who weren't sophisticated in architecture were just imitating the mini computer guys. And since the VAX was the next successful mini computer, it looked like what they were going to do is try and copy that instruction set of architecture, which meant a lot of microcode. So when I came back, I wrote this paper, said, look, if we're going to build microprocessors like they build the VAX, we're going to have a way to fix bugs in the microcode of microprocessors in the field. So I wrote that paper, and right after I came back, and it got rejected pretty quickly. And so I was faced with this quandary. I was absolutely convinced that microprocessors were going to be the way the mainstream of computers of the future. That, you know, at DEC, that was controversial. Microprocessors were these toys that went Apple IIs. Real men didn't use microprocessors. So, but it was clear to me that that was the future. And yet, if they imitate the VAX, that's going to be a stupid way to use silicon, because they're going to have RAM on the chip and patching, and it's going to be a big headache. So the fact that that seemed the way things were going, and that I agreed with the reviewers that didn't make any sense, led me to be interested in trying to architectures that make more sense for silicon implementation, that they could be designed quickly with the rapid changing technology and all that stuff. So that's where kind of the RISC name came from, is a simpler design that was a better match to the technology. Whereas the IBM guys were more interested in a simpler architecture that was a better match to the compiler technology. And they were doing stuff in ECL and stuff like that. So they were more of a good compiler target for an ECL mini computer. And we were doing work of a better architecture to match rapidly changing silicon technology. But those, you know, those ideas were close enough. And then Hennessy came along shortly thereafter, and he focused on the silicon technology, but then taking this kind of like an IBM compiler angle to it. So, you know, the three groups were all kind of joined at the hip, but with slightly different focus.
And kind of what year are we talking about?
This is, well, I know exactly, because my sabbatical was 1979, the fall of 79. We saw the leaves change in New England, my family. And so I got back in January. And when I got back, the other thing that had happened is at that time, when DARPA was funding a small number of universities, and if you were blessed by DARPA, you were king of the road, kind of, and had ample resources to do aggressive research. And Berkeley wasn't in that group, and a guy, Bob Roderson here, was trying to get it restarted. And when I came back, he kind of asked me what I was doing, and I had told him about the multiprocessor stuff that we'd been doing before, which wasn't all that wonderful, but it seemed like we should be working on multiprocessors because it was the problem of the future. And then he asked me, well, what do you want to do? Because he kind of didn't buy what I was saying. He said, well, I want to design a computer. He says, well, why don't you do that? So kind of the get to do the thing I wanted to do with the DARPA funding would allow that. And with the Meade-Conway stuff that was going on at the time meant we could do things in silicon. And then it was the question, okay, if you got to design computers in silicon and you had a clean slate, how should you design them? Should you follow the existing philosophy, which you know, Dave Diss will talk about trying to close the semantic gap of having some kind of instruction set that was closer, I guess, philosophically or logically to the programming languages? And that was one argument. And this other thing was, well, why don't we design things based kind of on experimental quantitative principles and something that matches the compiler technology of the time, and you know, and we don't care about programming assembly language anymore. We're going to program at no lower level than C. If he took this quantitative approach with a rapidly changing technology, what the state of the compiler technology? What should instruction sets look like? And that was, you know, that was the bet we made. And so shortly after he got back, I did basically the RISC course. That we're in the quarter system. So I think either that winter or the spring, we did the RISC course that pretty well laid out all the arguments. I think it was that summer that I wrote the paper that was the case for RISC, and I sent a copy to Dave Ditzel, who was back in Bell Labs, and he liked it so much that gave me so much feedback, then we turned it made it a kind of co-authored piece and started the debates.
So he was at Bell Labs, and so he'd already kind of studied under you.
Yeah, so he had... taken, you know, he talked about the symbol computer and the building things in gates, and so we wrote this paper together just before he got his master's degree about reconsidering high-level language computer architecture, kind of the case against high-level language computer architecture, that closing the semantic gap. That, and that paper talks about, well, what's wrong with compilers to close that semantic gap? That's not necessarily evil. And so we did that paper, and it appeared at the Computer Architecture Conference, and then Dave got the job at Bell Labs, and then that fall I went and took the leave at DEC. And then when I came back from that, we did this, and Dave was out at Bell Labs doing the beginnings of what became the CRISP architecture.
Right, and then I might be oversimplifying this, but basically, I mean, Sun Microsystems more or less built on the back of your work, and then MIPS and SGI kind of built on the back of Hennessy's work. Is that oversimplified or more or less?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how long you want this interview to be, but we just had an event at the Computer History Museum, so John and I were waxing nostalgic last night. So Gordon Bell convinced John that he should start a company. You know, they finished the MIPS stuff, and so John's decided to start a company. Bill Joy, who was doing the Berkeley Unix stuff the whole time we were doing the RISC stuff. In fact, we used the VAXes and Berkeley Unix to do our CAD work and simulations and all that stuff. So he approached me that he thought Sun, which was this little tiny company that fit in one building, ought to do its own instruction set architecture because he thought RISC was a good idea. They were using the 68000s. And so he recruited me on board, and I was the kind of the first guy that on the thing that led Spark Architecture, and I helped recruit some people to work on it. And so this little tiny company announced it was doing its own instruction set architecture at the same time that John started the MIPS Corporation to build silicon and boards to sell to people.
In the event you're talking about last night, was that like the award ceremony, or was that just a lecture?
No, John and I were inducted as fellows of the Computer History Museum, along with Maurice Chang of TSMC and Chuck Thacker of Xerox PARC Alto fame.
That's a pretty solid list. Yeah, congratulations.
Thank you.
kind of in retrospect, what do you make of the great CISC versus RISC debates when we had...
Yeah, I heard what Ditzel said, and there's this kind of PC focus out there. Gee, you know, there's a couple of billion cell phones that are all of us use, and a lot of us. I heard the Boeing. I heard somebody else has an iPhone on this phone line besides me, I'm pretty excited about the iPhone, and it doesn't have an x86 processor in it. Yeah, I'm pretty sure it's got an ARM processor in there, and that was influenced by the RISC papers there. So there's billions of RISC processors out there right now, and as we look down the road in the future, I'm not sure the PC desktop is going to be the most exciting place for computing in the next few years. So I think, you know, RISC processors are doing just fine, thank you.
Right. You know, I don't want to sidetrack us too much, but, you know, SGI just had their 25th anniversary, and obviously it's a company that's fallen on harder times than its heyday. And then
they abandoned their RISC architecture for Itanium.
Right.
So that was, I don't think that worked out.
Are you, you're not
in fact, this Sunday we're doing the 20th anniversary of Spark. There's a bunch of us are going to get in San Francisco who worked on the original one, and we're going to celebrate that event.
Oh, okay. You're going to have the event in San Francisco instead of out in the valley.
Yeah, it's gonna be an old timers thing. So Bill Joy will be there, and Robert Gardner, and you know, the guy Bernie LaCroot, who is the vice president of engineering. It's a nostalgia event.
and
right now, amazingly, you know, Sun has some very interesting microarchitectures out here with the Niagara 2 out there, and you know, it's competing with these monsters, but. So it's competing with these guys who have their own fab lines, and it's doing pretty well. So I'm kind of surprised that Sun's still has really interesting micro architectures in a time of pretty fierce competition. So I don't think it's about to disappear.
Yeah, Sun certainly isn't willing to give up on doing its own R&D work these days. And I mean, the Niagara seems to be selling well. I'm pretty curious, have you looked at the Rock design at all?
Yeah, we spent a lot of time with Niagara 2, and it's a pretty interesting architecture. It not only has interesting, you know, performance per watt, but it's actually its floating point performance is pretty darn good. And it's a real simple idea. It's a lot of memory bandwidth, a lot of threads, a lot of cores, not such a high clock rate. And, you know, the big challenge today for a lot of computational problems is how do you keep the memory system busy, and one way to do that is to have a lot of memory bandwidth and a lot of threads, and it's very effective compared to what Intel and AMD are making for these high performance floating point codes.
Yeah, just while we're on the subject, I wasn't planning on doing this, but what's your take on, you know, what IBM has done with Power 6 by keeping the gigahertz high and the core count low, and maybe also just Itanic and your...
Yeah, well, you know, Hennessy and I held up an edition of the book so that we could have that, you know, when the Itanium was finally revealed, and so we could, that seemed supposed to be a really important thing. And you know, what John said is, after he kind of wrote it up, well, you know, this is just another instruction set. This is not, you know, this is not a revolution, and it looks kind of, you know, it's kind of more one of those designs by committee than designed by a single strong person, and so. I'm amazed it's still out there. that I assume there's all kinds of contracts that would be painful for somebody to violate. But it's hard to see that's going to have a rosy future on the Itanium. You asked me about what else?
Well, about Power 6. Just, you know, IBM doesn't seem willing yet to go the radical kind of multi-core route, and they're still.
Yeah. Well, what I was told was they asked users or customers, what would you rather have after the Power 5? The next one, would you rather have twice as many cores at the same clock rate, or the same number of cores at twice the clock rate? Right? And, you know, if you ask people that question, they're going to pick same number of cores, higher clock rate. But then, boy, you better deliver on that, because if you did four cores, and even if the clock rate's a little slower than you expected, you still can sell it. But if you can't get the clock rate you promised, then you kind of have to wait for the clock rate to get there. And it seems like the Power 6, I mean, I haven't seen them out there yet. So there's some problem going on. So I think we'll have to see how difficult it'll be to deliver on that promise.
It definitely seems like they're struggling with yields, because there's only the one mid-range box that's been out there for months and months and months.
And what clock rate is that?
I mean, that one came out at, I want to say, 4 gigahertz, either just above it or just below it. And
yeah.
it definitely did not come out at the speeds IBM had kind of originally promised, but it was pretty close. And it's tearing through the benchmarks. It just doesn't seem like they can produce a ton of those chips. Otherwise, they would have filled out the rest of their system line, I think.
Yeah, I don't know anything, but yeah, you know, you kind of, well, like, you know, the other thing you kind of watch people talk about when they multi-core, they're going to keep the same clock rate, and that's their goal, but I'm not sure they've succeeded at that. And it seems like clock rates are headed down. So it's a really fascinating time right there.
Well, that's what I was going to say, because, you know, if you look at today, I mean, we've got mostly kind of dual, if you look at kind of the mainstream Unix or RISC server market, everything's mostly dual core and pretty similar between Sun, IBM, and Intel. Kind of each architecture has its merits. But then you look to 2008, and it seems that Intel's going to have a 4-core Itanium, and Sun will have this 16-core ROC chip, and then IBM is still going to be on more or less this dual core system. So there's going to be a lot of diversity for, you know, your mainstream Unix customer to pick from.
Don't forget they also have BlueJean machines and also the Cell project.
Yes, BlueJean's a really interesting high end computer, and Cell is right now not, you know, general purpose computing, so it's more closer to the game market. It'll be interesting to see how that works out. But yeah, I think we are just entering the era. Well, I think we've just ended the era where everybody knows the right thing to do, and we're all going to build the same thing. That era is over. We're about to enter where nobody knows what to do. Everybody's going to place different bets, and we're going to see a pretty diverse set of chips out there. It's going to be a lot harder to do those paper summaries in the register where you can easily capture what everybody's doing by, say, the clock rate.
Right.
And even when you see the PowerPoint engineering from Intel and AMD, everybody thinks in the future they'll be able to do a family of chips rather than a single chip. It won't just be the Pentium 4 at different clock rates. It's going to be a bunch of multi-cores with different number of cores per chip and different die sizes, and they're going to sell them all. And I think this just reflects the we really don't know what customers need and want, and so we're going to try. Everybody's going to place a lot of interesting bets.
Well, so do you have a feeling for what's going to pan out, or are you just as curious as everybody else?
I'm just as curious as everybody else. I was a cheerleader for the Niagara stuff, is that because I thought Sun could do that. It feels when you talk to some of these other guys, it's like Sun cheated. But they're just doing a bunch of simple cores at a low clock rate.
Right.
That's too easy. Well, you know, then Sun gets it done on time, and they can actually manufacture it, and they get yield and stuff like that. You know, there's they just need stuff to be more parallel, which, you know, for a server company seems like, you know, a reasonable bet. But it feels like when you talk, well, that's too easy. They should have done something harder than that.
Yeah, are you surprised nobody's tried to mimic it? I know.
Well, if you're doing a desktop computer and you're going to cut the clock rate in half to get more cores, that's a pretty scary thing to do.
Right.
So,
but even in the server
I guess I'm surprised
space.
That maybe – I guess it was just a risky thing. IBM could have done it. IBM could have done the same thing that Sun did. It was just – it was a bold thing to try. And, you know, the marketplace is going to figure out what they like. Right.
Right. Just to toot our horn, the Register did have a exclusive story on IBM had a research project called Q7, I think it was, if my memory serves me right, where they did actually do a Niagara copy. And according to my sources, they saw kind of twice the performance per thread and per watt, I suppose, but it's just sitting on the shelf last time I heard. So,
well, you know, when you got to bet the future, you know, some vice president is trying to pick what they're going to, you know, the future of the company is going to work out. You know, it's a tough call.
So just to dial back a little bit, and then I think we want to get back into this discussion, but I wanted to check, you know, how you think of a chip engineer or a systems guy, and then you went off and did RAID storage kind of in the middle of all this. You know, how did you get interested in that?
I come from a family of storytellers, so you have to be careful when you give me an opportunity. So I think as I reflect upon my career, I kind of go back and forth between basically small systems and big systems, typically microprocessors and big systems. But the story is that Randy Katz, this is my colleague here, we did about three generations of RISC projects, and then And by the third one, people were actually starting to do things commercially. So we felt like, okay, we've made that case. It's time to do something else. And then Randy got a Macintosh on his desk, and he happened to get a Macintosh that had a 5 1/4 inch disc as a supplemental box next to it. And so he kind of picked that up and said, gee, this is a pretty interesting building block. I wonder what we could do with this. And that question led us to the hypothesis that since RISC was going to make the processing really fast, that meant by Amdahl's law that the I.O., storage I.O. was going to be the bottleneck. So that would be a really good thing to work on. If processors were just about to get a lot faster, let's work on high-performance storage. So we wrote a paper that said, look, we could replace one of these big mainframe disks with, say, 50 of these small PC disks, and we'd have all this potential advantages in power and size and particularly performance. We'd have many more spindles and things like that. So we sent this to some of our friends at IBM, and kind of like the RISC story, they said, well, this is a stupid idea. If you replace one thing by 50 things, your mean time to failure is going to go up by a factor of 50, and it'll be breaking every week, and it's a bad idea. So we said, oh, well, that seems like a good point. So we said, well, then why don't we think about adding redundant copies? Since we've got 50 of them, it won't cost that much to add a few more. And kind of like ECC and memory inspired us, and so we spent time looking at a bunch of different ways to get that redundancy, starting off with mirroring, which was already a popular idea at the time. But mirroring meant twice as many disks, and you know, those of us in university budgets couldn't possibly afford twice as many, so we wanted to get something more economical. And when we went around talking to people about our ideas, they'd say, oh, yeah, I know what you mean, and Thinking Machines is doing that. And no, our ideas are different than that. And then we went, and every time we gave the talks, somebody knew somebody was doing exactly what we wanted. So we decided to go back and write a paper that was kind of tutorial in nature, a case for redundant arrays of inexpensive disks that laid out, well, here's the arguments why small form factor disks have an advantage over big ones, and then how could you organize a lot of them together, kind of like a multiprocessor. And then we laid out the 5 RAID levels just in part to point out what was everybody was doing and what our idea that was a little different than that. And that paper was a very popular paper.
Yeah, most definitely.
Understatement.
Yeah. And then, you know, I guess just, I think it was this week I did a story, or last week, Panassus, with whose CTO is Garth Gibson. I think he was one of your co-authors on that.
Right. And he was my graduate student, so it was Garth, Randy, and I on that paper.
And Panassus has now rolled out kind of what they're calling tiered parity, which is there. I guess they see it as better than what vendors call RAID 6.
Oh, that's interesting.
I was just curious if you'd looked at
it
at all.
Is it a clustered?
Well, you can still use their clustered file system to, you know, improve the performance, the overall performance. But they're doing network parity and then on disk parity. It's kind of these three different levels, so that. I guess their theory is that as disk drives are getting bigger and bigger,
right,
even as they get more reliable, customers are going to see a higher number of failures because you've got these 1 terabyte disks.
Yeah, it'll take forever to recover.
Well, that was the other thing. There's going to be more failures, and it's going to take forever to recover. So,
well, and then Garth is one of the people. There's both Google and people at Carnegie Mellon. Garth did some real studies about how do disks fail, or how frequently do they fail. And you know, up until now, we've all had to rely on the disk industry to tell us how reliable their disks are. But we actually got some big studies, and you know, there's a lot of surprises in there. I mean, not so surprising is the actual failures were much lower than the promised failure rates. But you know, to the disappointment of my friends in the disk industry, that SCSI disks weren't all that much more reliable than the cheap SATA disks, and that's just terrible news for them. So, but basically, well, the fact that we can actually have some more statistics based on failure, so disks are more reliable than they used to be, but they're not as reliable as people claim, and the fact that the capacity is so large, it takes a long time to recover from a failure, and that increases your window of vulnerability, which is the argument of that it seems much more likely to have failures, just more than one failure at a time. You have to protect them, and that's the RAID 6 and then the stuff that Garth's doing for protection, even up beyond the storage array, it sounds like.
Right, yeah, it's pretty interesting stuff. I'll be sure to put in a link to that. And also, I saw that Google study you mentioned. It is interesting because, it's pretty funny that the failure rates they show seem much more dramatic than the storage vendors would have you believe.
And it was like I was saying last night at the Computer Museum, when we had these risk sys arguments, these weren't, over sherry, smoking our pipe, talking in pros and cons. This was people yelling at each other, getting angry, and people were extremely emotional about that. Well, for the disk industry, if you claim that their SCSI disks aren't any more reliable than SATA disks, that's fighting words.
Right.
So they're pretty excited about all this. But, who are you going to believe? Google with whatever, however many hundreds of thousands of disks over several years data, or the disk industry, which puts 1,000 disks in a room for 6 weeks and counts failures, right?
So, you've done all this pioneering work, but I found, I think it was about a 1988 or maybe it was a little later, story by John Markoff in the New York Times. And he was kind of comparing you and John Hennessy, and, Hennessy's flirted with running companies and starting companies in the past, whereas you've more or less shied away from that. It seemed to be, according to, I think, a quote in Markoff's story, you seemed like you were just happier doing research rather than...
Yeah. Well, Stanford's got this reputation for having this huge impact on industry, and much more than Berkeley. And it's actually, I think the reality is that Stanford has impact by starting companies. And, my unbiased summary is that Berkeley starts industries.
Right.
So, but the good thing about starting a company when you have a success like MIPS or Google is they have their own publicity people, and it's in the news all the time, and you kind of remember that. That did come from Stanford. When you talk about the RAID industry, it's not like there's a publicity machine out there reminding everybody that RAID came from Berkeley, right? It's just, oh yeah, everybody knows that, but, kind of so what? So I think our philosophy has been to have our impact, trying to work with lots of companies to try and create a new industry, and that's been more the Berkeley style. It's worked well for us. And the Stanford style has been more likely to have professors start very successful companies, and I think that's worked well for Stanford too. So I think the kind of the Bay Area, the Valley, the industry has benefited from both philosophies. It's just that it's harder to our philosophy isn't as visible as the Stanford one.
But then you see John Hennessy over there, getting these Google options, and
yeah.
You must. There's no regret then when you see Google's share price hit 600, and you think, well he's probably
the amazing worth. Thing of my life. I was amazed when I met a millionaire in my career, and I met millionaires. Then it was 10 millionaires, 100 millionaires, billionaires, and I've met 10 billionaires. And it's part of my philosophy. But the amazing thing is, there's not that much you can do with all that money. What I've seen the people who have all that money is what they do is first they get everybody gets a really nice house. That's fun. And so I have a nice house. Then what they do, because they have so much money, they get a jet. So when I fly, I have to go to the airport, stand in line, get in the airplane, go to security. That's a real hassle. They don't have to do that. But that's kind of way up on the advantages that they have over me. And then they've got these little problems worried about people being friends with them because of how much money they have. I don't have that problem. And then everybody wants to hit them up for money, including me. As an academic. Oh, gee, why don't you fund this? And so, it's kind of surprising that since this is kind of, you could imagine the average American citizen growing up wants to become the richest person in the world, kind of in our culture. It's not quite as wonderful up close as you would have thought. So, John's got plenty of money because and I'm sure he gave great advice on the Google board. I mean, people don't kind of mention how valuable he was to Google. I'm
right.
Sure he was extraordinarily valuable to Google, and they've got so much money. He got, wheelbarrow full of it. But, do I wish I had that much money? It's not so obvious to me how my life would be better if I had that much money.
Tell you what, you stand in the C line for Southwest Airlines and you think having a jet would be pretty good.
Yeah, there aren't. Yeah, I was just on JetBlue sitting on the runway in John Kennedy. At that time, a private jet sounded pretty good. But most of the time, it's not that wonderful.
I think Chris can attest to this. I mean, you look at someone like Andy Bechtolsheim, he's got billions of dollars apparently, but I mean, every time I see that guy, he looks like, you know, he's just worked all night and slept at the office.
Andy is one of my heroes. In fact, when I was president of ACM, I gave him an award, a president's award, and the thing says that Andy overcame success to remain an outstanding engineer. But I've known him forever, right? And Andy Bechtolsheim 25 years ago and Andy Bechtolsheim now, he wore Birkenstocks, checked both boxes. He wears a polo shirt, checked both boxes. He drove a Porsche sports car then and one now. Maybe it's a little bit fancier model now. And like you said, he works like he's at a startup going out of business now, just like he did 25 years ago. He's a person that absolutely has been unaffected by the wealth and continued to make really valuable additions to the computing industry, right? He hasn't let money get in the way of doing these things. He's just a really admirable person.
Yeah. What do you call him, Chris? The hardest working billionaire in the business?
Yeah.
No, I mean, I think the reason, you know, I've been associated with Sun for a very long time, and, you know, there's been, in times past, it's easy to get depressed about Sun's future, but, you know, lately, you know, Andy's back designing really interesting boxes, and, you know, boxes that no one else is designing, and, you know, I think he's the world's best board box designer, and boy, it's good. Thank God Sun's got Andy back, so.
Right. So you just... Building on Sun and Berkeley, I was curious what your take is on Ivan Sutherland. I actually asked him to do a couple of interviews for a book, and it was the firmest no I've ever gotten in my life.
That's interesting.
He wanted no part of anyone busting into his privacy, and I've just always felt,
that's interesting. Well, he's here, you know.
Right. I mean, that's why, because I know he does a lot of work over at Berkeley.
Yeah, he hangs out at Berkeley, and, you know, he called me up and said, gee, you know, I'm looking for a change. And, well, how'd you like to spend time at Berkeley? And he both appreciated the fact that, because I guess one of my attractive features for him is I tell him the truth. and apparently when you're as famous as Ivan Sutherland, a lot of people will say, that looks really good, Ivan. Just keep doing the same thing. And I don't always do that. So he liked that. And then for me, having a guy like Ivan around Berkeley would be a really valuable person to have. And so it's been fun having him here.
So if you tell him the truth, why is he still working on this asynchronous clock stuff?
He stopped that.
He stopped. Okay.
You're pretty cruel.
Yeah. Well, no, I talked to him. He's doing other things now. He's got this fleet processor design of, suppose, how would you design a computer if, you know, it was really important to use wires efficiently? So it's not. It may end up using asynchrony, but it's not the fundamental thing behind it. But yes, I think I said to him kind of more or less what you just said, and in a maybe more polite way, and he found that novel.
Yeah, I think, you know, if anyone hasn't checked out Ivan's work, it's a pretty interesting journey. Yeah, if you go online,
he's the father of computer graphics, amongst which, you know, he hasn't worked on that in a long time. Yeah, I think I remember saying more or less to him one time, he said, I kind of gave him somewhat negative feedback on what he was doing, and he gave the counter argument. And he said, and I remember saying to him, well, that's all well and good, but that's not our advice, Ivan.
I interviewed three people who all described him as kind of like this brain sucking kind of creature. You go in and you feel like he's just taking all the knowledge out of your head while you were sitting there, and he's ended up knowing more about what you've spent your life working on than you did.
Yeah. No, what's nice about this field is it's young enough you can meet these giants of the industry and get to know them personally. So
yeah. So let's talk a little bit about your current research. You know, we've done a couple stories in the Register on, I guess it wasn't this last Hot Chips, but the one before. It must have been 2006.
RAMP?
Right. And maybe can you just describe?
You made fun of MIT and you picked up on it. I thought that was That was perfect.
can you give people who might not be familiar just the overview of the RAMP project?
Yeah, well, it's partly this multi-core thing. I mean, I kind of wake up every day astounded where we are in the computer industry, that the official conservative plan of these companies who thought RISC was a pretty wild and crazy idea. I don't know if we can embrace RISC. The official plan of these companies is they're betting the future of their companies that we will solve the parallel computing problem, and that they will deliver performance to people with laptops by doubling the number of processors per chip for the next 10 or 20 years. So I'm astounded that that's where we are. So we're pretty sure that that's an unsolved problem. So we need some way to innovate in hardware and software to attack possibly the hardest problem computer science has ever faced. And so we were at a architecture conference about 2.5 years ago, kicking this around in the hallways. And basically the idea came up was that, well, what we need is a way to do hardware software systems rapidly evolve. And then we said, well, you know, all of us use FPGAs to teach our classes, to teach logic design. FPGAs are growing with Moore's Law. Probably the way multi-core is going to turn out is it's going to be lots of simpler cores rather than fewer really complicated cores. And if they're simple, we could fit a lot of them inside of FPGA. So how about we build a platform so that everybody could have a common platform to do this very important multiprocessor research? And the way we'll do that is we'll standardize in the hardware, and we will take standard instruction sets and getting IP from open core movements or from the companies, and build up an infrastructure, an open source infrastructure around FPGAs. And what this will mean is if we can pull this off, instead of 5 years between iterations of chips, in the tape out and the fab and all that stuff, you can tape out a chip every day, basically. And you can innovate extremely rapidly in architecture at a time where we absolutely need extremely rapid innovation in architecture. And so the name we hit upon was Research Accelerator for Multiprocessors, or RAMP.
So you're required by law to have a four-letter acronym that starts with R for all your major projects.
Yeah, well, yeah, one of my students graduated, and he said, he introduced me, and I gave a talk at Michigan. This is Pete Chin, and he introduced me as saying, and what I learned from Dave is systems research projects need to start with R. But I think for an academic, I've got a marketing knack, because my colleagues come up with terrible names that you can't pronounce or remember how to spell. So I try to keep them small and memorable.
Yeah, all yours have stuck. So, and can you give us? I remember when you, if my memory serves me correct, I mean, you were kind of building these boards in stages. Where are we right now as far as?
Well, I just saw Chuck Thacker. One of the really great things, Chuck Thacker, one of the pioneers of computing, who basically built the first, you know, the Alto, the first real personal bitmap computer, mouse computer, he got interested in RAMP. I helped talk him into it. And so Microsoft, under Chuck's leadership, is building the next generation of boards. And I just talked to him last night, and he said the generation that we plan to make available for other people are back. You know, we've got the boards, and they're populated with chips. We've got the first five boards. And so, you know, nothing like having a great designer like Chuck working on this thing, but we're ready for testing. So I think, if anything, we're ahead of schedule. We hope to have the boards and firmware available for people to buy who want to do research in this area, you know, starting next year. And, you know, Chuck didn't just do this out of the goodness of his heart. You know, Microsoft Research wants to get involved in this multiprocessor, multi-core thing, and so they are going to use these RAMP boards.
So Microsoft's going to use these internally only, or they're going to distribute them?
No, the idea is the design is Microsoft, you know, it's a, Berkeley and Microsoft cooperated on the design, and the designs are going to be out there to buy from third-party people so that anybody can use it. Now, Microsoft is just going to be, in addition to helping us design it, they're going to be one of the customers who's going to buy them and use them themselves inside of Microsoft.
I see. And I mean, when you're talking about a third-party distributor, who do you have in mind, like a traditional server vendor? Or?
No, this would be one of these little, I mean, this is for researchers, so
right.
The volumes are not high. So this will be some small company who finds making, you know, whatever it is, hundreds of boards or thousands of boards for academics or researchers, an attractive business model. So this won't be anybody big.
I didn't know if you were going to talk John Fowler and his son into maybe cranking a few out.
I doubt that.
So that's pretty interesting, though. So Microsoft, you know, because they get a lot of flack for not being really up to speed with the multi-threaded software. But here, I mean, we see Chuck Thacker then definitely trying to take sort of a leadership position figuring this out.
Yeah, you'll hear more stuff of them trying to, you know, they're doing lots of stuff to now to try and help with this problem facing the whole industry, right? It's not just Microsoft that's got this problem.
Right.
It's the whole industry has this problem. And, you know, Microsoft is one of the companies that's stepping up to try and, you know, what I say is we got to get this is a real crisis, and we need to get the best minds working on this. And so Microsoft and Intel and others are trying to marshal the whole research community to work on this. And I think you'll hear about more things like this that they're trying to do to get everybody to be able to help work on it.
When you're talking about kind of this pending crisis with the software, I guess it's a server and a PC issue, but I mean, you tend to focus more on the server side stuff.
For me, as I look forward, the way we've been talking about this for a while, we're thinking at the two ends of the spectrum. The warehouse size computers that Microsoft and Google make is the one end, which I think is really interesting in the future and become more popular. And the other end is these portable things like laptops or cell phones, things like that. So we're focusing on those two ends of the spectrum. So for multi-core and, you know, the warehouse size computers, that's a match made in heaven. You know, that's wonderful. The thing that you carry around with you that operates from a battery, that's a much harder challenge. So we're probably spending more of our attention on this, on the more mobile thing than on the server.
Oh, okay. I didn't realize that.
Well, we're just unveiling our plans as we speak. We got together about 2.5 years ago to start talking about the problem and how we're going to attack it, and our ideas are getting sharper over time.
So this is something that's going to be announced in the coming months, or this?
Yeah, next month.
Oh, at supercomputing.
Stay tuned. Stay tuned.
Is it a supercomputing thing or not related to that?
It'll be, I think, coincidentally announced before supercomputing, but not related. We're focusing more on the mobile things.
Right.
You know, how would you put, you know, 32 or 64 processors and do something interesting either in a laptop or in an iPhone, and what would those applications be like? What would the programming model be like? You know, that's the research agenda that we're interested in.
Okay. Can I get a little heads up on that when it's coming?
Yeah. I absolutely.
Chris, I know, Chris, you were kind of curious about Dave's take on what? On like the on GPUs, and is that right?
Oh, yeah, that's really
fast. Well, I was curious what he thought about all of the trends in computing right now to deal with the lack of more frequency in processors, such as GPGPU, the use of FPGAs as coprocessors, and, you know, all the other projects that have been going on related to those things.
Yeah, so I think FPGAs are just wonderful in the classroom and for this idea that we're building these emulators of multiprocessors of the future. They're fantastic for that. I think in terms of as a computation device, it's, you know, they've had a long time to try and make that one work, and it's been pretty modest progress there. I'm sure there are applications that it's a perfect match, but I just don't think it's wildly generalizable. So on the GPU side, though, the GPGPU, boy, that's really fascinating stuff. There's a whole industry behind it that's used to making lots of chips. They innovate very rapidly. They don't really have binary compatibility. They've got a device driver interface, so there's a layer you can program to, and what they actually build is below that, so they can drop things out and add stuff all the time. So it's a very fascinating different bet than the standard microprocessor industry. And we spent time talking to the NVIDIA folks here and find it really intriguing what that's going to turn out to be.
Yeah, hear the rumors are that they're headed towards double precision in the next generation of those chips, which will make them very useful for HPC and other applications.
Yeah, well, they seem to be, they're using the term general purpose GPU, and NVIDIA announced a they announced a graphics chip with no graphics. So it's focused on computation. So and because they don't have this binary compatibility saddle they have to carry with them everywhere they go, they are amazing at the rate that they insert new ideas. And of course they have, and then they have the world's biggest chips. I don't really understand how they can have chips that big and sell them for such a low price, but you know, somehow they do. And they and I think they change things every year or every 6 months. So it's a pretty interesting vector that they're on, and they clearly are trying to make them easier to program than they used to be. So where's that all going to end up is really hard to know, but it's certainly fascinating how far they've come and interesting to see where they're going to end up.
What did you think when you saw Google acquire PeakStream?
Yeah, I mean, just Google is this amazing company. I mean, I heard, like when I talk about Ivan Sutherland, his granddaughter went to work for Google, and they're teaching her to get a commercial airline pilot's license. So what in the world does Google want commercial pilots for? What's the plan there?
Well, they, don't forget, they do have a private 767.
I don't think that's what they do. I don't think they'd hire, a graduate student researcher and train her to be a pilot.
Isn't that what it is? Actually, I think it's a 767, and they're planning to park it over it.
At NASA Ames.
I'm sure there's plenty of pilots you could hire with more experience. So they've got, so yeah, they do all kinds of interesting things. For a company, did they just acquire the people, or was the technology, and who knows? But, you know, presumably, it would be really fascinating if one of the things that they want to do down in the future need a lot more floating point than we expect. You know, GPUs would be, I could imagine that Google is smart enough about their software that they could figure out a way to put GPUs to very good use if they needed a lot more flops than they need right now.
Seriously, why is Google sending these people to...
No, they're one of our sponsors, but I have no idea, right? but they try everything, you know, as far as I can tell. I think, what a great company to work for. They ship products, and then they figure out whether they can make money on them later. So.
Right. Maybe they're doing, data centers in flight kind of thing. Who knows? So overall, I mean, you don't sound... It seems like this whole co-processor accelerator thing is making a bit of a comeback, but you don't sound hugely bullish on the long-term prospects, unless I'm...
I assume... Well, what the GPU guys say is, look, we run this 100 times faster. So that's great. What about this other stuff? And he says, well, we don't have to run that. So so for the things that they run well, it's, you know, you can't beat them. And I think, what's the long-term version of this? Well, as part of becoming more programmable, will they start showing up with a standard processor in there that so they aren't wedded to a PC anymore? And, you know, that wouldn't be rocket science. It may screw up. I mean, it may have business implications, but it's easy to imagine an ARM processor or something else in there, and then they could do more of the problem.
Do you think that we might be headed to a world of hybrid machines, where it's hybrid computing architectures, say, you know, CISC, RISC, and GPGPU combinations all in one machine?
I would say that. I would think if you look at the Intel PowerPoint, they've got, you know, big cores, small cores, and special purpose units as part of the game plan. Kind of like Niagara 2 has special purpose units for the Mac and the encryption and stuff like that, that kind of special purpose units. The Intel people are doing this Larrabee design, which is a real fascinating take on the GPU space that's using x86 processors. AMD buying ATI. So yeah, it's kind of hard to imagine that we won't be seeing a lot more mixed designs in the future than we've seen in the past. And the marked differentiation, which seemed to be crystal clear a few years ago, I think you'd have to bet that it's going to be a lot fuzzier going forward. And the really amazing thing is, like 10 years from now, if we could peek into the future and find out who won the multi-core wars, you know, it could be NVIDIA. You know, they've got a kind of a head start, and they're not quite as programmed. The markets, they're focused on a narrow market, but they've got multi-core and they innovate faster. And what an amazing thing to say is it's possible that 10 years from now, a company like NVIDIA could be the dinosaur that rules the planet rather than the companies that have ruled it so far.
If that happens, I will definitely give you credit in 10 years' time for calling that one.
I didn't say, I said possible.
don't backtrack now. You've got it going.
Oh, yeah.
That's... and when you're looking at, you know, I know you focused on performance per watt stuff as well, that you've, you know, paid a lot of attention to that.
This is important everywhere, but particularly in warehouse data centers or things with batteries, everybody was worried about power.
This might be a stupid way to ask the question, but I was just curious. I mean, I hear from the energy guys that we're heading to a crisis point with data center power, and then the software guys, we hear we're at a crisis point with the multi-threaded code not catching up to the chips. I mean, which one hurts us first?
You mean that we can't take advantage of the multi-core? Is that?
Yeah, I mean, basically, it seems like the chip. You know, I know these things play leapfrog over time, but it seems like the chip guys were thinking about 8 cores next year and 16 after that. And, you know, you look at mainstream software and it's just not there yet to handle it. And then you talk to the data center operators and they say, look, there's no more space to add more capacity. And even though the performance per watt stuff is improving, you know, there's just only so many systems you could add. It seems like we have two crisis is coming, and I just wonder, you know, which one's the bigger worry for you?
For me, I'm worried about the future. If we don't figure out a way, well, basically, the industry, for 20 years, we've doubled performance every 18 months, and that's been valuable to everybody because all software runs faster. And that era's over. I'm pretty worried about the future of the industry is as we double cores every 2 years, and if that does not get turned into performance, what's going to happen to the industry? Will conventional wisdom be...
I think our skyline's died, so maybe we should... I think we're just leaving off with kind of your thoughts on where things were going. Maybe we'll make this our last question since we're suffering from some technical difficulties. Could you just give us that last...
Yeah, I think there's two issues here. One of them is, can we figure out a way to make computing more power efficient, or can make space more power efficient. And the other one, what about the software facing the multi-core? And so I think the latter is what I'm really worried about, because if we get to the point at 16 cores per laptop or 32 cores per laptop, and people say, look, there's no software in the world that can take advantage of twice as many, so don't waste your time buying a new laptop or cell phone or whatever, then boy, that's bad news for the computer industry, because then maybe go from a growth industry to a replacement industry, and presumably sales start heading south. And what's going to happen? What's the computer industry going to be like if it's shrinking? Right? I think that's really dangerous. In terms of the power of the data center, I think there's a lot of innovative things that people do, like Sun doing this containerized computers, and people talking about building air conditioning units into racks. So I think that there's many innovations out there that in kind of packaging or reconsidering how you build a data center that we haven't taken advantage of yet. So it's easy to imagine that problem getting solved over the next few years than solving a problem that we've, you know, blunted our axe on many times over the last several decades. That just seems like a much harder problem.
Right. Well, Dave, I want to thank you. I want to apologize for Skype's inadequacies.
Well, that may have been something to do with our wireless at Berkeley, too.
Yeah, sometimes Skype doesn't like the wireless connections. It kind of prefers wired, in my experience. But I can't thank you enough for coming on the show. This was a real treat for me. And Chris, thanks as always for your time as well.
All right. Well, this has been fun getting a chance to talk about the past and the future.
Thank you, Dave.
We'll definitely have to do it again.
Okay. That's a deal.